Welcome back, everyone, to At HGO Football. I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, but we're joined by a very special friend of the pod, a chat we get on more than we'd like to admit, but we just love the nostalgia chats. You may only hear us for 30 or 40 minutes, but we're normally off air for another hour either side of the podcast with Mr. Michael Hamlin of 80s, 90s football. Michael, how are you? You well?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you, guys. No, not too bad at all.
Andrew, you well?
Yeah, good. All mince pied up, stuff in, leftovers, all full to the brim. So I've surely got enough in my stomach for this chat.
It's a meaty chat. You know, it's a meaty chat. Apologies if you had a nut roast over the festive period. This is a meaty one. We're talking about the greatest international team that never was. That's right. We're talking about the decade that changed football, but a team that was missing in Yugoslavia. And the breakup there, which maybe denied the footballing world of certainly a run in 92, certainly a run in 94, certainly a run in 96. And let's be honest, across those three tournaments, probably a win somewhere, if not two, from Yugoslavia. Michael, there's a fantastic article for your website, which I'd absolutely recommend people go and read and deep dive in and post this chat if they listen to this and it sounds interesting. But we spoke the last time, actually, we had you on the pod and we all had a chat, was about Italia 90 and the legacy that that kind of left. And it absolutely did. You know, modern football kind of flowed from there in terms of globalization, in terms of, you know, the modern rules, if nothing else, and as well as just sort of like intrigue and interest across the game. But we can't help thinking, if we look at the late 80s, at those the Yugoslavia youth teams, that the world might be denied a pretty decent outfit.
Oh, very much so. I've thought that for years. Yeah, and, you know, you're quite right. You know, we spoke about Italia 90, and that's when, you know, this team came to my conscience as a child. And, you know, then you start reading and researching, and as you grow older, and then, you know, you start looking back at, you know, the 87 World Youth Championship, and then you then look at the players available throughout the next 10 years, if that country stayed together, and you just got to think, wow, those players, those names, they're just ridiculous.
I mean, looking back at in hindsight, obviously, as you know, Tom and I wouldn't have been completely focused on, you know, a team like Croatia, for example, in Euro 96 or 98. We obviously had our eyes on Arsenal growing up, and obviously how England were doing. But looking back retrospectively now, that was this wasn't just a group of players that looked to be having a purple patch in the 90s that would just like look like they were having a decent run of form. This all dates back to, as Tom alluded to a minute ago, 1987 in the FIFA Youth World Championships, right, Mike?
Yeah, no, you're quite right. There was a number of players came through all at the same time, at various different sort of clubs. But yeah, predominantly, you know, Croatian and Serbian, but they, as I said, they came through. They went to Chile, the 87 championship. They were sent more of an obligation than actual any sort of sense that they would actually go and win it. But, you know, they won the tournament. They breezed through the group. You know, they beat Chile 4-2, Australia 4-0, and they beat Togo 4-1. They beat Brazil in the quarterfinal 2-1, beat East Germany 2-1 semi-final, and then beat West Germany on penalties in the final. But, you know, the players that they had, you know, you had Davor Suke, you had Boban, you had Igor Stimac, you had Mijatovic, and of course you had Prozinecki, and other players like Jugovic and Mihailovic were stopped from going. It was deemed they'd get more experience playing in the Yugoslavian league. And so you look at the players that I've mentioned who went and the players that didn't go, you probably know those players already. If you're into nostalgic football like me, then you'll know those names and you'll just think, wow, what a team that was. And what a collection of players. I don't know another youth team that's had a better collection of players that's then gone on to achieve what those guys went and achieved.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of obviously France's success with Clairefontaine, which obviously then kind of led to them having obviously international success at World Cup level, European Championships. Yet sort of two parallel stories there, obviously one that was fulfilled and one that obviously wasn't, sadly, in the end. And obviously Prozinecki picking up the player of the tournament in that Youth Championships, who I'm sure you admire.
Oh, it was one of my favourite. I saw him at Portsmouth when I was at uni, and I've said this before, he was just on a different planet, on a different level. And as I know that Portsmouth were in the time of the championship, but, you know, he controlled games from the centre circle and didn't run. And you just think, how the hell does he do this? And he's smoking 40 fags a day. You know, he didn't do any training before the game. He just took shots at the goalie and free kicks. It was just an absolute pleasure to watch him on a Saturday afternoon when I was at uni.
And I think that you've reeled off the names there, and there's a couple, as you say, they didn't go to the youth tournament necessarily, but would have gone on and starred in the 90s, you know, St. Mihajlovic, Bilic. They are household names. So if we have got any younger listeners than us on the line, and you're thinking Yugoslavia, that sounds some Soviet team I've never heard of, you know, from a bygone era of my grandparents, let alone my parents. We are talking household names, and you've reeled them there, and actually the names resonate, and they could have been together, and they could have had that collective. If we can then ask you, Michael, that, you know, they do the youth tournament, late 80s, we're gearing towards world spectacles, obviously, of European championships and Italian IT. How does the Yugoslavia, how do they shape up in that, where they're still eligible before the dawn of what would have been a fantastic team? How do they go in 88, 90?
Well, 88, they didn't go to Euro 88. They didn't qualify, but they went to Italia 90 and they got to the quarterfinals and went out to Argentina. But, you know, as we spoke about before, you know, they got beaten 4-1 by Germany in that Lothar Matthäus inspired victory. They then went and beat Colombia 1-0, and then they beat the UAE and qualified, I suppose, quite comfortably for the next round. But as I said to you before, it's the Spain games, the one that it always sticks in my mind, you know, with Jagan Stojkovic. There's another name we haven't mentioned. So this is one of the more established players, destroying Spain with two brilliant goals, which I've described before. And obviously they went and played Argentina. They had a player sent off after 31 minutes, but they still outplayed Argentina. But in true Argentina fashion, they completely ruined the game and played for penalties. To be fair, Argentina did have a few chances to win as well, but they were outplayed. And of course, they had Goycochiri, who saved the penalties and, you know, knocked Yugoslavia out. But you then look at, in between 90 and 92, you've then got Red Star Belgrade and winning the European Cup in 91. And again, a lot of the names that I've already talked about are in that side. So, you know, you've got Savicevic, actually, that's another new name to enter into the fray. So, you know, what a player he was. And, you know, you've got sort of Darko Panchev as another player. And, you know, Prozanecki and Mihajlovic. And I know that the game against Marseille is a really boring game and it's a dull final. But the winner's name on the 91 trophy is Red Star Belgrade. And, you know, if you watch any of those games against Bayern Munich or against, I think it's Dynamo Berlin, or Dynamo Berlin, they were just sensational. And I know I've had on my Twitter page, Red Star played Man United in the Super Cup and United won the game 1-0, but they, not Man United fans say how they were outplayed and how they were played off the park that day and they do not know how they won. So it was a fantastic side, the Red Star Belgrade side, and all of that team was Yugoslavian apart from Beledeji, who was Romanian. And he, funny enough, he defected from Romania and served a ban before he was allowed to play football again and ends up becoming the first player to win European Cup of two different teams. And I think personally, Beledeji, I know we're not talking Romania today, but I think he's one of the most underrated players in world football of all time. And then, of course, you then go to 92 and they qualified for Euro 92. The players that they had at their disposal was unreal. You know, you had, you know, the players I've talked about, but then you had like Katanec as well. You got Slaven Bilic, you got Robert Jarni. You know, you look at the talent that was available if the country didn't implode and go to war before Euro 92, you look at that squad and you just think, wow, what a team. If anything, their team was probably too good and I wouldn't envy the manager picking the starting 11 because I wouldn't know who to pick.
And let's, you know, 92 is remembered for being an open tournament that the boys on the beach who actually replaced Yugoslavia go on and win it in Denmark, you know, and we were speaking off air that actually, if you look at 92, obviously that's a sort of a fairy tale run, if you're Danish anyway. You know, you look at 96, Euro 96, and the England run, but obviously being pipped by Germany. And then you look at France 98, you don't, and of course USA 94 with Brazil side there, what you do not have is a global side that is in the echelons of football. You don't have a Brazil 70 side. You don't have a France going on in the Euro 2000 side at their peak of dominance. You don't have the Spain back to back. You know, they did the triple, didn't they, in the run in the late 2000s. So what I mean by that is you don't have a dominating force. There was an opportunity there for Yugoslavia with the talent that they had at 92, 94, 96, 98. You've got four bites at the cherry there, don't you? And they're going to win a couple there, aren't they? They're going to be right there anyway.
I believe that 100%. You know, the group that they were actually originally drawn in for USA 94 before they were excluded. The group was, I think it was Soviet Union, Greece. I can't remember the other two sides actually off the top of my head, but it was a very doable group, let's say that. And obviously Greece went to the World Cup, so I've got no doubt in my mind that they would have gone to that World Cup. Mm. And, you know, these players, as I said, they were young in 87. You've now fast forward another 7 years. You've got a bit more experience. They're now playing for top clubs. You look at who these players now play for. You look at Boban and Savicevic at AC Milan. You know, you look at, I know Darko Pencil went to Inter Milan, it didn't work out. But, you know, Prozinecki's gone to Real Madrid. You know, Jukovic has gone to Sampdoria and Juventus. It's just, you know, they're playing for top clubs. They're challenging for European honours every season. It's just scary.
It's interesting that you look at the landscape of European football in the 80s, very much dominated by, obviously, like a great AC Milan side, the Italian approach to football. Put it that way, with the defensive sort of setup, and then in the Italia 90 kicking off that decade that obviously led to commercialism in the game, and a decade that was very much remembered for Serie A. But in terms of the Yugoslavian players, if we were to sort of focus in on here, like on the characteristics of an academy player at that point, and say that let's take that youth World Championships as an example, Mike. What sort of characteristics defined a Yugoslavian talent at that time?
Well, you've got to remember that the academy system isn't the same as what you get over in, obviously, the West, and it's not in the same as what you have in other Eastern European states. They didn't seem to plough the money into them like other countries did. But Yugoslavia was basically called, you know, the Brazilians of Europe. And I think that's because they naturally come with an attacking style of football. Very, very technically gifted players. I think that they come with a degree of grit and determination as well. So I think if you've got a determined, technically gifted player, you're halfway there, aren't you? More than halfway there. I don't know quite what it is in the water over there that seems to produce these technically gifted players. You then, you know, look at the modern day, you look at Modric and you look at Rakitic and players Kovacic. Like that, and you just think it's not just the one. You know, don't be wrong, I think the concentration of players in the 90s, I still think, outweighs what you've seen modern. But you look at, you know, Croatia, you know, get to a World Cup final in 2018, and they get to semi-finals, you know, last month, or this month, I should say, in 2022, and you think there's something in the water over here that technically that there's, I know there's aspirations and there's inspirations from the past, don't get me wrong, but they just seem to be technically gifted players.
Mm. We spoke to Callum Murray, actually, whose title of his book is Something in the Water, and he's delving into hotbeds in this country. But I just kind of wanted your sort of take on the... I know we're not going to go too deeply into the political sort of stance of this whole topic, but... Was that at play in terms of just also the way the players felt about things and their approach to the game, and was politics very much involved in terms of the football side of things for Yugoslavia, or was it very much kept kind of separate?
I think there's a number of different factors there. I think for the fans, it definitely was. I think with the fans, when they, you know, when Serbian fans went to Croatia and, you know, it's in the article, and I'm sure you guys, you know, read that, but about when the Maksimir in May 1990, where Red Star Belgrade went and played Dinamo Zagreb, and it basically descends into chaos and there's fighting and Boban kicks a policeman and he's banned and he doesn't go to Italia 90. There's loads of videos on YouTube about this, so I won't go into too much detail about that. But it was definitely for the fans an opportunity to showcase their politics and their aspirations or ethnicity, nationalism, whatever you want to call it. In terms of football side, a lot of these players were friends. You know, obviously they come through 87, they knew each other, they got on with each other. They just wanted to play football. And, you know, I think they knew what was going on because they've also got family, they've got friends. And, you know, some of the players, you know, Mihajlovic, you know, he came from Vukovar, which was a town that was destroyed by the Serbs. And, you know, he was almost, his parents survived because of who he was. Mm. But when they went back to the town later, they found photographs shot through the heart of the parents, you know, almost to symbolise, well, this is what would have happened. And it's just, you just can't imagine that. And it almost puts the story into some sort of perspective to say, well, you know, 100,000 people died and loads of people were, you know, 2 million people were missed, you know, were forced to be removed from their homes. And this story almost sort of doesn't compare to that. But at the end of the day, when you're a football fan, it always eats away at you, doesn't it? As much as like, oh, it's the great unknown in my mind and in my... it's always a great discussion, this one, in my mind.
And you're right, I think football at all times, no matter how passionate we are, all supporters of the game and how much we love our clubs and our countries when they perform, in reality it pales into insignificance versus is real issues, real lives, and war. And we've almost seen that a little bit as a spectacle recently with obviously the World Cup in Qatar and obviously the controversy that surrounded that, but nonetheless, in many ways, it's such a uniting force as well. And you still saw the spectacle of football on the pitch of the World Cup, the recent World Cup being so fantastic. And in that very same tone as to what you're saying there, Mike, in terms of, well, actually, yes, it's a horrific situation, but we're still, you know, one of the things that could have united is we denied a fantastic football side, you know, and a fantastic decade of spectacle, which could have been really additive to people across the globe because of their love for football. And I think that's always a shame. I'm reading some of the deep dive on the names of the team, and I think you're probably talking about 9 or 10 European Cup / Champions Leagues across the squad winners that would have been, had they been all together. You're talking about multiple Golden Boot winners, including European Golden Boot winners as well. So again, I think it's worth just mentioning that we are not talking about just a good outfit here. We're not talking about, let's be honest, the Croatia of the 2018 and 22 runs where they've just punched above their weight and done really well. We're talking about genuinely among the very best footballers on the planet being denied the chance in some instances to even play at all in a couple of those tournaments, but also and certainly to play together. So I think it's a massive shame for us as all fans to have missed it.
Isn't that no coincidence as well that, you know, a large percentage of that group of players were plying their trade in Serie A, which was by far the best league in Europe at the time, you know. And
the others are at small clubs like Real Madrid and Barcelona. Do you know what I mean? It's just, you know, those small teams. I don't know if you've heard of those. You know, like you say, testament, really, you know, to the level we're playing
at. To wax lyrical, just about a couple of players that kind of really spring to my mind. I don't know about you, Mike, but Boban in that AC Milan shirt, just on you know, on Gazzetta dello Sport, was just so iconic. And also, Tom mentioned Real Madrid a minute ago, but I really vividly remember Mijatovic playing for Real Madrid in that lovely kit that had the purple on it as well. Into some of those Champions League nights for Real Madrid, particularly for him. But just two names there. I'm sure you can obviously wax lyrical about one of your favourites.
Oh, well, I love Davor Suka. You know, he sort of played for Seville with Maradona for a bit as well. You know, sort of on 93, and then, as you say, went to sort of Real Madrid. And then, unfortunately, he comes to Arsenal and he's just past his best and goes to West Ham. But, you know, Alan Bocic as well, that's another player we haven't talked about. You know, you think a player that was forever injured, unfortunately, but, you know, wins the sort of Champions League with Marseille in 93 and then goes to Lazio and Juventus and then he ends up in Middlesbrough, you know. Another fantastically gifted player who, unfortunately for him, as I said, was injured at international tournaments. And I think he went to Euro 96. Well, he didn't go to France. He didn't go to one of the tournaments anyway because he was injured. And you just think, wow, you know, what a player. You know, Savicevic, you know, again, Savicevic and Boban are together at Milan. I think that, unfortunately for them, they're in a period where you had the foreigner rule in Serie A. So, you know, when you've got Van Basten, Hulett, Rijkaard, Papin, Savicevic, Boban. There's three players that are missing out, and I think that Boban and Savicevic would have played more games if it wasn't for the foreigner rule, definitely. You know, Jugovic, I think Jugovic is one of the most underrated players. He's never discussed. He's never one of these players. He's not one of the big, almost sexy names, shall we say, but he was a player that did his business. You know, he won the European Cup, you know, with Red Star. He wins the Champions League, Super Cup, Intercontinental Cup with Juventus. And you just think, what a highly decorated player. You win the European Cup twice, and it's not a player we don't even talk about.
Yeah.
But again, the player that I love the most is always Jagan Stojkovic. And I think that that's born out of being my little eight-year-old self. You know, I loved Marseille around that time as well. I loved Red Star Belgrade around that time in 91. And then unfortunately he gets injured and you never really see the best of him ever again. You know, then he reappears obviously at France 98 in Euro 2000. But these players, I think, they're all players, I don't know, you guys are younger than me, but when I was playing Championship Manager in Central World of Soccer in the 90s, these are the players I always tried to buy. Whatever club I was playing with, I always tried to buy these players, and you know, invariably you couldn't because they're too expensive, they're too good. But just the list of players is just staggering. It just is unbelievable.
No, you're right. I mean, earlier we were talking about, like, you know, I think Tom mentioned it. Was it nine players, Tom, or something? 9 or 10 that had Champions League, you know?
Yeah, well, if you're counting doubles, it's probably double figures in terms of, like, you know,
I think we spoke about this before the World Cup, Tom, about if the squad in the World Cup with the most Champions League winners in it, you know, and we're really struggling to get
up until, Madrid have done what they've done in the last 5 or 6 years in terms of winning the multiples all in a row.
Yeah.
I think you'd have struggled in any other point in history to pull together a team who've done that.
Yeah, an
international team who had that number. But I think because of Real Madrid's run, you look at the Spain squad and stuff like that over the last couple of years, they would have had multiples. But other than that, like, you're really struggling, you know, just by having one player in there or two, you're counting 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 European Cups just by two players, essentially. That's what that would have, you know, properly swayed it. Whereas this team, you're probably talking about eight or nine different individuals, which is astonishing, really. And that level of quality, and again, you referenced the Championship Manager, but you're right. And whether it was Yugoslavian players, or I remember being in Andrew's bedroom in sort of 98, 99, playing sort of with Hadji or getting players like that, because we as English fans, it still wasn't, and we spoke about this off here, it still wasn't the level of, you can't watch every minute of these players. You know, I know they're plying their trade for Juventus, for Milan, for Barcelona, for Real Madrid, but you still cannot watch every minute like you can do today. So you're just so keen to see the moments and glimpses of quality. I remember as an Arsenal fan, obviously I was signing Suker off the back of the World Cup in 98 and being so excited about the quality. Everyone remembers the lob goal and all that kind of stuff. Like you said, past their best by the time a lot of these players came to English shores when they did arrive. But they were fated because of what they'd done in the game. So, I mean, an astonishing place. Is there any example that springs to mind, Michael or Andrew, of anything that we've seen close to this in respect of being denied a team? You know, and I know, you know, you think back to historically, you know, Busby Bay, stuff like that, and you know, you wonder what teams could have gone on to do. But like, it's rare, isn't it? You're talking one hand, the amount of times that we've been denied a team of quality, essentially.
I think, you know, the Busby Babes, you know, what would have happened if Duncan Edwards, you know, had survived, and what would have happened at the 58 World Cup, and, you know, what would have happened at 62 and 66, you know, that debate comes, you know, sort of is brought up quite a bit. I think the Zambia team in 93, when they get wiped out in an aeroplane crash, they were on the verge of qualifying for USA 94 and lost sort of 9 or 10 players. And that was a really, really, really tragic story. But it's going to sound a bit horrible to say this, but they're not at the same level of this team. No. Shocking for African football, but they're not of the same caliber.
And sadly, you know, in most of these cases where we're trying to sort of find another example of this, the ones that have happened in the past, like the Busby Babes and obviously the Zambia side, they're all in light of tragedy, really, of some sort, or you know, a collapse of something. And we've not really had the only if only team I think we can probably maybe mention is someone like a Colombia in the 90s as well, that were obviously had a top side that went into, I think that was more of USA 94 in isolation, really. They obviously tipped to go on and win that, but that's obviously a weak comparison that I'm trying to find there, really.
The other one you can throw into the mix is, and I've written on this one, is the Soviet Union in the 90s. You know, there were some really, really top players there that when that country fell apart, they then obviously split into 17 different nations, but that was slightly different. They weren't excluded from playing football. And a lot of those players were actually allowed to come to play for Russia still and go to the World Cup. And some players turned their back on their new nations to do exactly that. Mm. Some players weren't going to play for Russia and were going to play for the new country. But again, you're not talking the same talent level as this.
No. I mean, there's probably the odd country you can think of at the moment if we were trying to stumble on a really, you know, modern side who, I mean, Norway have got some top players. If we're going for this in terms of, you know, a country that we might say in five, six years that could be challenging or doing well in a tournament like a Croatia have done. Norway have obviously got, you know, one of the best players on the planet. Odegaard's not bad himself either.
I thought you were talking about Martin Odegaard when you said one of the best players on the planet.
Yeah.
So I thought you were talking about. No, you're right. And I think what's exciting is we should look at the sides that could be the team Yugoslavia could go on, which should have gone on and be. But the reason I asked the provocative question is because I don't think there is really an example, not on an international stage, certainly, not to the same level where you are denied pomp. You know, it's a bit like, you know, Muhammad Ali's being denied two or three golden years, you know, that kind of thing. You are denying through no fault of players or no tragic accident. You're denying a spectacle for a good two or three tournaments, which could have bought some incredible stories on the pitch. And who knows, we might be sitting here now had they played, and they might not have won a single Dickie Bird. But the reality is, it's that unknown, isn't it, Mike? Well, that's the shame of it as a football fan. Certainly. So your abiding memories. You know, you spoke about your favourite players from the Yugoslavian team that wasn't. Is there any? What do you think the legacy of that team and that era left for the region? Obviously broken up, but also for as individuals, do you think it was tarnished as their own individual legacies?
I don't think for the Croatian players, if I'm honest, because I think that, you know, that was a nation that was born. I think if you look at Euro 96. I'll be honest, I don't think many people really knew who Croatia were, if I'm honest. I know this is going to sound arrogant. I know I did because, you know, England played Croatia in a friendly. I think it was 0-0, but, you know, I knew Prozanecki, I knew Boban, I knew Bocic, I knew Suker, I knew this team was a good side. I don't know if I actually really knew about Bilic and Stimac at this point, if they'd actually started playing for Derby and West Ham. But again, this is a country that sort of appears out of nowhere, does really well. You know, it'd be forever remembered for the chip over Schmeichel. You know, they then lost to Germany, but I was watching a, I don't know if you guys have seen it, the Croatia Defining a Nation film on
FIFA, need to see that.
Which is a fantastic documentary, which I recommend anyone to go and watch that. You know, they wanted revenge for that defeat to Germany. There were some shocking decisions in that game, and it was almost like the Germans were a bit more streetwise, a bit more experienced, and I think that it gave them, they wanted revenge, which that they got in France 98 when they beat them 3-0. So I think for the Croatian players, their legacy, I think, is assured. And, you know, the likes of Modric, they look up to that generation and that inspires them. So you then look what the current Croatian generation have done, and that all stems from the roots from the 90s, from the inspiration. So I think Croatia have got that legacy. I think Serbia doesn't, mainly because I don't think they had the... Obviously, they couldn't qualify until France 98. They got through the second round, but went out to Holland. They then went to Euro 2000. They got knocked out again by Holland. But the difference was in the second time, they got beaten 6-1 by Holland. You know, this was the team that had, you know, they'd gone over their peak, and, you know, they're just going down the hill. And I think since then, I know Serbia have been to World Cups, but they're probably most remembered for being in the end of Cambiasso's goal in 2006. Mm. They haven't really done anything. And, you know, they've had good players. You know, they've had sort of Stankovic, and they've had other players as well, but they just haven't done it. The other nations, unfortunately, like Slovenia and Macedonia, they don't have the talent pool to pull on. Mm. I know Slovenia did punch above their weight because they did go to, I think they went to Euro 2000, they went to France 98 and didn't do spectacularly well. I think they might have even gone to Japan, Korea 2002. So I think from their point of view, they're a smaller nation. I suppose less is expected of them. But I think with Croatia and Serbia, Serbia is probably the one that just hasn't got the legacy. And I think they've probably suffered more, maybe, for what the talent pool they had, and especially when they had Red Star Belgrade, which is nowhere near what it will be. But that's the same for all Eastern European clubs because of commercialism, money. That's just the way it is. So it's overall, it's a very, very sad story. But for the Croatians, I think they've made something out of it.
How about in terms of legacy and more of a coaching tactical perspective, Mike? Because, you know, so you look at some obviously iconic sides over the years that have an impact on the game for different reasons. So, for example, you know, the great Barcelona team in the sort of the early 2010s with Pep is often looked at as a side that changed the footballing landscape for years to come in a tactical point of view, whereas like a team like the Galacticos didn't necessarily have that sort of impact on the game from in a coaching development way. It was more just a very iconic group of players. How about this? Would you say this group obviously lends itself more towards the Galactico type of impact than the Barcelona effect?
If you're talking to Yugoslavia, a whole, if they all stay together, then I probably would say you are looking at a Galactico type of scenario where you've got some top, top world-class players. And I suppose the challenge for any manager would be is how you get these people to be on the same hymn sheet, controlling and managing those egos. And, you know, Del Bosque did it for Spain, didn't he? You know, he managed to get the Barcelona Real Madrid players to play together. You know, they hate each other in theory, but he managed to get them to play for Spain and win three tournaments. So I think that if you look at the individual, I suppose, teams, what they do then have is a sense of pride and sort of patriotism almost, especially the Croats. And I think that's where a lot of that team comes from. Tactically, yes, you know, Blažević was a very good coach for Croatia. And tactically, he was okay. He wasn't the best in the world, but what he was a very, very good motivator. And he managed to get the players to believe that they were the best.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember watching, you know, Slaven Bilic basically said, you know, we knew it was all a lie, the way that he spoke to us and said, you're the best player in this position. You know, the opposition you're playing are, you know, you are inferior or better, and, you know, but they bought into it and believed it, and that's what made that team such. I mean, don't get me wrong, they had the talent as well, but they had the determination and belief.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is really because if you took a group of say 100 football fans at random and you asked them to name some iconic Eastern European / Yugoslavian players, we'd probably be able to reel off a handful of them, particularly if you're of a certain age. Yet if you ask the same group of, you know, fans, can you name a great Eastern European coach or manager, I think most would struggle, wouldn't they? Was there that sort of impact in terms of on coaching in that part of Europe, or was it more a case of, like you're saying, the more motivational type coaches, not necessarily groundbreaking tactics?
I think it's more motivational. You only really, I can only actually name two Yugoslavian managers, or three actually, and, you know, Blažević being one of them, you know, Osim, who was the Yugoslavian manager in 1990.
Never heard of these guys, by the way.
You have or you haven't?
Never heard of them.
Sorry. You know, Osim was manager of Italia 90. He was the manager that qualified for Euro 92. And obviously then that didn't happen. And he was a Bosnian. So you can imagine the sort of turmoil he had inside himself being a Bosnian. You know, they talk about this. I'm going off piece a little bit here, so bear with me, but they talked about this sort of quota of players from each republic that you had to have, which was like this unwritten quota. So you had to have a Slovenian player, you had to have a Macedonian player, and around 1990 it was quite easy to do because you had Pančev from Macedonia, you had Katanić from Slovenia, you had Croatia and Serbia, quite easy to define, but within Montenegro you had Savicevic, so it was quite easy by default almost to do that. And then of course the other manager is Boskov, and he's the guy that won Serie A for Sampdoria in 91. And won the Cup Winners' Cup in 1990 with Sampdoria. So he was a manager of that great Sampdoria side of the early 90s, which was probably around the time that Serie A got Channel 4, you know, Glatzo launches. So he was the manager of them, and then he did go back and manage, I think he goes and manages Yugoslavia or Serbia back in the late 90s. But there's those three coaches, I think, but they're quite tough people. But they're quite, I think Boskov was quite tactically astute, to be fair. But the others, and Ossian was as well, both tough, but motivations. They're all motivators.
Mm. Bilic, obviously, in the modern day, not necessarily tearing up trees in a managerial career.
I just thought it was quite interesting that, you know, it's more the players that we all remember from that era than the managers.
Yeah, completely. Fascinating. And I think, when you say that era is really apt, because I'm conscious on time, but what for me really stands out is that what you're not dealing with is a country, or frankly a region, that is blessed with a huge success prior to or likely success in the immediate future, given the resources. And you mentioned that, Mike, later on in the pod, in respect of the quantity of resources, money, glamour and brand that is now attached to other Western countries and the top five leagues in Europe, that kind of thing, that you probably do not see or can't envisage, and hopefully I'm wrong, and maybe I'm wrong, but you can't necessarily envisage a swing back to the regions of Eastern European becoming football powerhouses again because of just the quantity of money being pushed elsewhere. And so what we were denied in the 90s is yes, a decade of great success, but potentially they're their only chance to really become a dominant force in world football. I.e., if you take out 10 years of Brazil over the last 80, 90, 100 years, it probably wouldn't matter. You know, they're still going to be, you know, drowning in success from the next 10 years or the 10 years after that. Whereas actually the sadness, I think, attached to this story is that it was a golden team of talent and generation and a moment in time where football didn't have a dominating force, didn't have the money in the game that there is today, which is there for concentrated in other areas. So fascinating, an area that I didn't know enough about, and I found it really interesting to read about in the last couple of days. So thank you as ever for your time, Michael. And we could always go on all night. I hope and I wish you success in the New Year's Day fixtures, but not too much success because it's Brighton Arsenal. So hopefully you'll get a consolation goal after we've scored our fifth. Andrew, pleasure as ever. Stay listening to everyone at HGO Football. Please also check out 80s 90s Football and this article in particular, because it's a cracker, and we'll be back soon.